Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While public health officials are still fighting a pandemic here in the United States and around the world, another set of emergency managers are gearing up for another season of wildfire in the American West. Just before COVID-19 struck, Australia's East Coast was reeling from some of the worst wildfires in their history. And in California, the cost of fighting this new normal of wildfires went from just $90 million 10 years ago to almost $1 billion in 2018. And that was prior to one of the deadliest and most destructive fires in the American West just 18 months ago. The Camp Fire in Northern California claimed the lives of at least 85 people, destroyed the town of Paradise, which was home to 27,000 people, and cost over $16.5 billion in losses. Reporters Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano covered the Camp Fire for The Guardian from that very first day, November 8th, and followed the story in the days and months afterwards, recounting the heroism of individuals that morning and stories of survival. The fire, which started at 6 o'clock from a PG&E high-voltage line just a few miles from town, raced at speeds of upwards of 20 miles per hour. By 9 o'clock, the whole town was consumed in fire, and resulting in a chaotic evacuation that overwhelmed the town's ability to fight the fire or escape. G. and Anguiano are the authors of Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy, a new book from Norton. They join me today on Studio Tulsa. Alistair and Danny, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
In your book, Fire in Paradise, you write something that really stuck with me. Yeah, about halfway through the book, you write that, you know, in a natural disaster, no one tries to divert a hurricane, tornado, or an earthquake. But humans, at least in the past century, have always thought that they could control wildfire. Do you believe that view is now changing today?
I think that fires like Paradise are showing that, yes, that view is increasingly untenable. There is this amazing and very inspiring history, in a way, of when a very deadly fire in the 19th century, in the Midwest and in the West, you know, they altered attitudes to firefighting in the sense that people realized that they had to take wildfires seriously. And it started this incredible period where, you know, the federal government, where state governments became really good at putting out fires. In fact, they became so good that, loss of life radically decreased. People were able, in large parts of the West, to move out to forested wilderness areas, you know, thanks to, our new aircraft that we commissioned after World War II, you know, former bombers and whatnot. And people were drafted into these firefighting forces. All of a sudden, fire seemed like something that could be tamed. And what we're seeing, particularly in the last decade, with a number of what are scientists call mega fires, particularly in California. We've had a fire tornado, believe it or not. We had deadly fires in California's wine country that killed dozens of people. And then we had the fire in Paradise, which became not only the deadliest fire ever in recorded California history, but the deadliest in America in 100 years. And it's these succession of fires that are really throwing into question all these old certainties about can fire be controlled. And I think what we're realizing now is that increasingly perhaps the answer is no.
And, you know, what's interesting is that this comes in the wake of last summer's fires, summer in the southern hemisphere, in another Mediterranean area, the coastlands of Australia, which were equally and even worse, I think, hugely more devastating just to the size and scope of the fires.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, between those fires, which we know killed something just shocking, like a billion animals, and, you know, what happened in Paradise, where this fire raced into this small suburban American town and, you know, essentially destroyed this town that had been home to 27,000 people. I think as we see those images from around the world, from Australia to Paradise, we're realizing that, you know, perhaps we can't control fire the way we thought we could.
It's also interesting here in the Midwest, in the plains, if you will, most people tend to think of seasonal fire is of a Mountain West issue, either in the mountains, intermountain region, or in California along the coastline. But, you know, a few years ago in a drought, we had some devastating plains wildfires that nearly engulfed a couple of towns in Oklahoma. I mean, this is an increasingly global phenomenon. But I want to talk a little bit about the campfire, which you write about so movingly in Fire in Paradise, which, of course, destroyed the town of Paradise, California, killed at least 85 people, perhaps the worst in the American West as far as death toll and cost. It's a horrible tragedy. And you write movingly about the tragedy and the heroism of the people that day. But I have to ask you, do you think it was a singular event or perhaps a harbinger of a new normal with climate change?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think what we saw on the morning of November 8, 2018, was just this confluence of events that really set the stage for this very deadly fire. Not only did we have the effects of climate change, California's had three or four of its driest ever years in recorded history just in the last decade. Its snowpack is getting smaller every year. So we have the effects of climate change. We have the effects of, we've been so good at putting out these forest fires, as I mentioned, for the past century, that forests are now, they're used to being burned, and now because we've taken fire out of a system, the forests are unnaturally tangled and dense, which ironically makes them more flammable. And then, the final two factors that proved to be so decisive on November 8th was we had this very, very powerful wind that was blowing in off the deserts of the western U.S. And we also had a power line not far from Paradise. And that power line had an outage. It sparked. And the wind just picked up these embers, these flames, and flung them at speeds that firefighters and indeed, the wildfire textbooks didn't think was possible towards the town of Paradise. So churning through this very dry vegetation, this climate change, dried vegetation, at least in part, churning through this very thick undergrowth, it just made this very deadly beeline for the town.
And Danny, at the time, I think you were working at an area newspaper in Chico, the Enterprise Record. You've probably covered wildfire pretty regularly. What I was surprised about in Fire in Paradise was how quickly it flared. I think it was thought to have sparked at 6 a.m. outside of Paradise. By 9 a.m., the town is engulfed. Is that unusual?
Absolutely. I worked as a reporter in the area for several years, and I covered multiple wildfires, some that were pretty bad and burned down a few dozen homes, but none quite like this. At the time, I was actually had just started working for The Guardian in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I started hearing from family and friends that morning who lived in the area about this fire. And as I said, I'd covered fire in the area before. It's not unusual to have fires around Paradise, but a fire like this, it was pretty clear right away that this was not usual. It was moving really, really fast, as Alistair said, faster than people knew was possible. In fact, it was so quick that, the firefighters were trying to get a hold on it. And then, dispatch 911 started getting calls from people inside the town saying, there's a fire in my backyard, or I can see fire in town. And it had moved so fast that the 911 dispatchers didn't know and said, no, there's not a fire in town. And then pretty quickly after, they realized there was. So pretty much everyone on the ground, from firefighters to 911 dispatchers who are used to seeing fire in that area and all sorts of disasters, it completely shocked them how quickly it came.
And as you mentioned, Alistair, we believe that it began with a PG&E high voltage line that sparked. And this gets to another big issue. I mean, you cover a number of issues. You cover sort of the history of fire suppression and how this was a factor. You also cover how California's reliance on abundant electricity was a factor, and how PG&E didn't keep up their lines. They had towers that were over 100 years old that they were slowly, but nonetheless, replacing, but it wasn't happening nearly fast enough. And this is a part of a long string of events tied to the utility sparking fires.
Yeah, I mean, you don't normally think of electrical utilities as household names, but PG&E actually is one. It was the unwitting or unwilling star of the movie Erin Brockovich. It was that was the company that polluted the water in the town of Hinckley that the lawyer Erin Brockovich comes into battle. And you know, since then, PG&E, which operates tens of thousands of lines of electric lines, of gas lines, it's been implicated in several other catastrophes in the state. There was a very deadly gas pipeline explosion that killed over 10 people in the Bay Area. And there have just been literally thousands of wildfires that its equipment has sparked, leading to deaths and lawsuits, leading to various findings that it has diverted money that was intended for maintenance and instead given that back to shareholders as profit sharing. And so it's really been a beleaguered entity that has already declared bankrupt once and has recently declared bankruptcy again. And what we know about PG&E is that, you know, the people on the ground, from everything that everyone says, the line men and line women who are doing the job are dedicated to their work. They are professionals. They are doing a very hard job, you know, climbing up power lines in the middle of winter, you know, with rattlesnakes all around and whatnot. I mean, you know, like the California outback is quite, you know, a rough place. And these are brave people doing a job, but for whatever reason, you know, that's not translating into the kind of mass maintenance that needs to be undertaken. And so the specific transmission tower that sparked the fire was 99 years old. We know that several other towers or parts of the line it was on had actually been mooted for inclusion on the National Register of Historic Places. It was so old. And PG&E itself, the Wall Street Journal found, had been saying that that particular power line or parts of it needed to be replaced decades ago. And so you have this utility that isn't keeping up with maintenance with a line that it itself suggests is too old. And that became the root cause of this fire.
Of course, also a major factor was the whole geographic siting of Paradise in the foothills of the Sierra. Limited access in and out, only a couple of ways out of town, away from the mountains. And just, again, the sheer speed of this particular wildfire. And I guess I keep coming back to the idea that, you know, my notion of wildfire, and it may be totally erroneous, is when it begins fairly small. It begins to build, and usually in the afternoon when the winds build, that's when they really grow and can get out of hand. This happened first thing in the morning, usually when you would think of the winds as being sort of down.
Right, yeah. Paradise was surprising in so many ways. As we said, you know, fire is normal in that area, but nothing like this. And the thing about Paradise in that area is what made it beautiful is also what made it dangerous in terms of wildfires. So just to paint a picture for you, it's located in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It's about a 15-minute drive up from the valley that's filled with rice fields and all sorts of other agriculture. And when you drive up into Paradise, you get these beautiful sweeping views of the valley, the rice fields that I mentioned, and this tiny little mountain range. And then you get into Paradise, and it's located on this ridge among the trees. So you're just sort of under this canopy of thousands and thousands of trees. And that's why people love to live there. They live there for, you know, the natural beauty and the proximity to nature, to camping, to fishing, that sort of thing. And then this fire came on November 8th, and it moved so quickly that no one really had any time to prepare. I think sometimes when we hear about fires, the instinct is to say, well, why didn't they leave? Why didn't they leave sooner? But in this instance, that just wasn't possible. This fire swept over almost the entire town at once that morning of November 8th, when people were just beginning their work day, when they had just dropped their kids off at school. And what happened from there was essentially everyone needed to get out at once. You know, all 27,000 people or so that lived there hit the road at the same time, which in every town in America, if every person tried to leave at the same time, it would inevitably result in gridlock. And that's exactly what we saw in Paradise. So you had these three main roads out of town down into the valley that were just completely at a standstill with traffic, with fire burning all around them. It was so difficult that one nurse we talked to, after she had helped evacuate all of her patients, she didn't even bother getting in her car because she could see that there was no way she was going to drive out of the hospital. So she and three other nurses just started walking past the burning buildings and past the traffic, just looking for a way out.
My guests today are Alistair Xi. He's the editor and reporter at The Guardian. Danny Anguiano writes for The Guardian and was also reporting, was a reporter for the Chico Enterprise Record. But at the time, she was reporting for The Guardian. They're the co-authors of Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. It's published by Norton. And some of the stories you relate, the story of the hospital evacuating as this fire is coming down, you know, the normal protocol would be to get ambulances in. There was not even time to get ambulances. You had basically staff putting patients in their car and driving out.
Exactly. This moved so quickly that in the course of one staff meeting that we document, you know, it started out as a staff meeting at 8 a.m. or so in the morning, and it ended, you know, 15 or 20 minutes later with the person in charge of the hospital saying, we have to evacuate right now. And so you had nurses rushing into patients' rooms saying, you have to get ready to go right now. There was one woman who just had a C-section who was suddenly told, we have to get you up with your newborn immediately. And they bundled this woman into a car with what she thought was the hospital's maintenance worker and hung her IV bag onto the mirror. There were nurses, doctors, just responsible for incredible acts of bravery. They not only had to hustle the patients out themselves, but then they had to figure out their own way out of town. And there was one guy named Alan, and he, after getting everyone out, he drove out into his truck on the street, and he got stuck in this gridlock. It was so hot that the paint on the outside of his van started to blacken like a marshmallow, and he thought he was going to die. And he, in fact, recorded a message for his loved ones that he hoped would survive the fire. And then, remarkably, you know, he was... that there was a remarkable rescue that saved him. But these people, not only did they save other people's lives, but their own lives were in peril as well.
You tell stories of early on in the fire, and I believe this was up higher than Paradise, the little town above Paradise that was closer to the line, where a family basically went into this mountain lake in November. We have to remember, this is November. This is not a time to be... wading into a mountain lake. They basically took refuge in the lake to survive.
This was another amazing story. It was a family that the husband was a former firefighter, and he had insomnia. And so he had all the old radio scanners that he just loved to listen to. He loved to stay in touch with what was going on with the firefighters, and he had them in his living room. Because he had insomnia, you know, that night just happened to be the night that he couldn't renew his prescription for his usual sleeping pills. And so he was awake all night. And so he heard, actually, the first transmissions from the firefighters on the scene who discovered the fire. And that gave them a crucial head start. He was able to wake his family, to wake his in-laws and the home next door. His in-laws were able to escape, but he heard another radio transmission after they had gone saying that the road they were on was now blocked. And so with his wife and his two sons and their two dogs and their cat, the only place that they could think to escape to was the lake itself. And so they ran down to the lake. The fire came up to the edge of the lake. They edged out into the reeds in the lake. The reeds themselves started catching fire. One of an elderly man they had brought with them was falling over in the reeds and saying, leave me, you know, just save yourself, effectively. the wife, herself a nurse, and the sons, they got into the water there and they started swimming in the lake, swimming across the lake, trying to figure out how to escape with smoke and fire all around them. And so eventually they found a boat and they struck out for shore, but they had left, you know, the husband behind. They didn't know what happened to him. And so that they didn't know what to do. They were in the middle of a lake in the middle of a fire. It was really an astonishing story.
Of course, there were tales of bravery. You talked about some of the firefighters that instead of leaving town, headed towards the fire, even as the fire was completely out of control. Really amazing story. There's also some socioeconomic dimensions to this story that you also probe into. The fact that a lot of Paradise's population were elderly. Some of them were retirees. Some of them had bought there just because land was cheaper than other places, than they've been priced out of more pricier parts of California. Some were disabled. And this was another dimension of this particular story in Paradise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Paradise was a lot different than I think the California that comes to mind for people, you know, Bay Area with the tech industry or the film industry in Los Angeles. Paradise was a much more rural part of California, and as you said, it was a lot more affordable. It was a place where a young family could actually still afford to buy a home, or where a retiree knew that his or her life savings would last them there. So you had a lot of people who lived there because it was beautiful, but also because it was where they could afford. I think of one man in particular named John, whose family had lived there for probably 100 years, and there was nowhere else in the world he would have rather have lived. There was so much history there. He was the town historian. But also, it was affordable. His family always joked that he just never had a dollar to his name his whole life, despite his best efforts. And so that was a place he could afford to make a life for himself. And it's a place that meant a lot to him. His story is actually one of my favorites because he was so dedicated to his community. He was a former volunteer firefighter. And the morning of the fire, he decided to tell his adult daughter that she needed to go and evacuate. And he decided that this town that he had loved so much, that he had made a home for himself over the decades, he was going to stay and try to save it. And that's what he tried to do that day.
Yeah. What's also interesting about this story was that usually when a wildfire moves through, people come back, they find out if their home is still standing. If it is, they try to salvage what's salvageable. If it's not, again, you're going through rubble and trying to save keepsakes. In Paradise, you're talking about how long before people were able to come back to the community?
Immediately after the fire, the fire moved through town in about a day, but the fire continued to burn for almost 2 weeks. So partly for that reason, and partly because there were so many remains of people who died in the fire still in the town, and also partly because of concerns around looting, the town was cordoned off from anyone until it was late November, early December, and people weren't able to re-enter unless they were a first responder. And so certainly for that period, there was a massive, very acute refugee crisis, you might call it, of 30 to 45,000 people who'd been displaced from Paradise and the surrounding towns, forced into the valley or into other areas with nowhere else to go. And the town finally did reopen after the body recovery operations had finished, and they found, you know, ultimately the death toll was about 85. But the town that they discovered had been almost completely destroyed. Over 90% of the buildings had been destroyed, 14,000 homes had been destroyed in the fire. And so even if people wanted to return to Paradise permanently, it was likely that they had nowhere to live. And so what we've seen in the long term is a massive reduction in Paradise population. Only about 15% of the population has returned. And we've seen an exodus of people not only to surrounding towns in California, but to Oregon, to Hawaii, to Florida, to Texas, to all over the U.S., really, because people's perilous foothold in California, which is such an expensive state, was just wiped out on that one day.
And that, as you mentioned, that refugee situation continues now 18 months later. Yeah, where people have left, perhaps never to return, and try to start over somewhere else. Your book details the real dangers of living in the early 21st century in wildlands, forested areas prone to wildfire on a seasonal basis, in a time with climate change, which undoubtedly is playing a role in these ever-growing, more dangerous fires in forested areas. Well, today we're living through a public health disaster, which is made worse by dense urban living. As I was reading Fire in Paradise, I just couldn't help but notice this dichotomy today, where if you try to get away from urban areas, you have one set of dangers. You know, today with a pandemic, being in a dense urban area makes you more susceptible. I was wondering if you've had any of those thoughts as well as you reflect on the book you've written at this particular time.
Absolutely. It certainly feels like nowhere is safe from disaster. And I think, you know, in 21st century America, you know, living through a climate crisis and now living through this public health crisis, I think that's certainly true, is everywhere comes with risk. What's happening here, you know, we're all sheltering in place here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it reminds me in some ways of what it was like covering the fire. I was out and about on the ground, but for my family who lived in the area and for everyone else who lived near where the fire was in November 2018, they were all inside their houses all day, every day, because the smoke was so bad that no one could be outside, just watching the news. And it's a very familiar feeling today to be inside right now trying to avoid this pandemic.
Yeah. Alistair, for you?
I think what's so striking is that both of these crises have a similar source, in my view, which is connected with the way that we humans are, we're changing the natural world, and we think that we've domesticated the natural world, but actually, you know, it's not something that can be domesticated. I mean, the coronavirus emerged, we're not totally sure how, but it appears that it emerged in connection with wildlife trafficking, with the destruction of tropical or forest habitat, which enabled this virus to cross from its natural host to humans, perhaps through trafficked animals. And similarly, the deadly wildfires that we are seeing nowadays, the connection there is that, you know, we're changing forests, we're putting out fires there, we are changing the very climate with anthropogenic climate change. And so they both have this common cause of the way that we are living in the world and the way that we are changing the world, not always for the better. And you might say that it's coming back to bite us in the behind.
Well, we hope you stay safe during this particular time. And thank you for a really interesting book on this terrible tragedy, the Paradise Fire in November of 2018. Alistair and Danny, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano are reporters and editors for The Guardian newspaper and the authors of Fire in Paradise, an American tragedy. It's published by North. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.